You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to another installment of the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I'm doing this broadcast earlier in the week than normal. And today's date is the 13th of October, 2024. When this actually goes up, I don't know. But some of you may remember, this back in 2016, I wrote a book called The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failure of the Western Engagement with the Islamic World. And, of course, there I focused mostly on ISIS and Afghanistan and Syria. But now we're dealing with very similar dynamics between Israel and Hezbollah. And that's what we're going to be dealing with today. The key player, as far as Tel Aviv is concerned, is the United States, that has absolutely no objective interest in this. Keep in mind that the Americans get zero oil from the Middle East or Central Asia. The U.S. is self-sufficient, but whatever it needs otherwise, from whether it be Britain, offshore, Mexico, Canada, Norway. So the only reason the U.S. continues to be involved is Israel. And that means to demonize her opponents and to spread this studied ignorance about the nature of her enemies in the region. Hezbollah turned out to be an unlikely victor in this regard. It's very clear right now that the IDF has met its match and is having a very tough time dealing with Hamas, which isn't all that different from Hezbollah. And under no circumstances, now it's been just over a year, they're nowhere closer to winning than they were 6 months ago. But Hezbollah is a part of a much larger axis of resistance. Their point is to counter American and Israeli influence throughout the Middle East, and of course, to fight the imposition of liberalism, economically and every other way, on the population. Now, it was September 28th of this year that the Lebanese National Resistance announced that its leader, Nasrallah, was killed after a massive bombing of that Beirut suburb. I was reading the Middle East Eye just a few weeks ago, and they traced Hezbollah going from a local militia to a very large political movement with branches around the world and the largest political party in Lebanon. And this was in part due to Nasrallah. The article was, who was Hassan Nasrallah, leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah, and why did he matter? You got to remember that Americans, academics and otherwise, they have access to, what, 30% of the available information. Their lives are sanitized and censored. You do a Google search on anything of any political substance, you have millions of words censored out by the system. I use Yandex these days, and they're completely different responses. That means in terms of any research that any precocious American might do, they really believe that there is no opposition to their regime. In 2018, the parliamentary elections in Lebanon saw Hezbollah wanting, they have a very complex voting system, but they won almost 400,000 preferential votes, the most for any party in Lebanon since its independence. Its population is like 5.5 million, something like that. Nasrallah, contrary to propaganda, was genuinely popular. And it wasn't just among Shiites. It was the population of South Lebanon. It's unfortunate that the Christians in Lebanon have largely supported Israel. There's no good reason for that. It may be economic. But this is a non-state actor that have become a regional military force. More than once, they drove the IDF out of South Lebanon and defeated the Christian South Lebanon Army in 2000 and 2006. Nasrallah had a humble lifestyle, which is very different from your typical politician, especially there. There was an interview that I saw. His monthly salary was capped at $1,300 a month. But really, he doesn't care about people's opinion of him. He cares about the nature of the resistance. Now, his murder doesn't make a lot of strategic sense. It makes a lot of psychological sense. Rhetorically, it is a violation of every conceivable kind of international law. It is an act of terror. But the most it's going to do is reinforce this resistance movement in the western part of Asia. It also convinces more and more people that the Zionist entity and the regime in general is dangerous. Netanyahu's legacy is to mobilize millions of people against the Israeli system. The Jews have done damage control by pretending to be against all of this. We've talked about this in the past. But in general, American and Zionist policy centers around brute force and control, not understanding and not knowledge. Today, though, the problem is the U.S. can't muster the resources to do either one. Hezbollah is a regular force, a conventional force, and is formidable with its own intelligence service and everything else. They are very well trained. They're very well equipped. They are very motivated and well led. They're all battle-hardened veterans. They fought the Western-backed Al-Qaeda and ISIS during the war in Syria, and of course those organizations were supported by the Israelis and by the regime. They have a institutionalized, not a cult of personality, they have an institutionalized command structure, and it's organized in such a way that no amount of Israeli assault could ever remove it. And again, they're legitimately popular, unlike the U.S. government or the Israelis. You take a description like that and you oppose it to the American military. And this is why I say, because they can't handle the fact that the U.S. is no longer a world power, they project those unfortunate feelings to others. And so they create this myth of the ragtag psycho-terrorist group called Hezbollah. And it's not merely that this attack and the Gaza war has turned people against Israel. But almost by definition, the Jews who benefit from it and the lobby in Washington, D.C. I don't think any knowledgeable person believes that the IDF, especially now that it's bogged down, can defeat Hezbollah in a regular conventional ground battle. They couldn't defeat them in 2006. They couldn't defeat them in 2000. Even, you know, having total command of the skies, they can't do it, especially today. Not only has Hezbollah's capacity grown tremendously, but thanks to the war in Ukraine, the U.S. just simply doesn't have the material to give anymore. Keep in mind, though, that Hezbollah isn't merely a political party or even a conventional military force, but it is part of an overarching resistance movement. Now, in this case, locally, it was to defend Lebanon against the Israelis, especially the mercenaries in the South Lebanon Army occupying, you know, half the country. But this is, like Hamas, Hezbollah is a multidimensional organization. It's not just military. It's political, social, military. and is a key part in protecting the sovereignty of Lebanon. Hezbollah, again, without the benefit of a state, has become an important regional player. You guys noticed that ISIS has just fallen out of existence? Wouldn't you think that the one thing, an organization that large and wealthy, that they could fight the Syrians to a standstill, wouldn't they be involved in Gaza or Lebanon? They're nowhere to be found. One of the things that Hezbollah did was, of course, supporting President Assad in Syria. And, of course, is very pro-Russian, just like Hamas is. When this war began a year ago, a lot of people began to speculate as to what the Lebanese and Hezbollah's role is going to be in it. Israel can't have this vulnerability to the north, so it's got to begin destroying everything that it doesn't understand. There will be no annihilation of the resistance in Gaza, and even if there were, it would not be without consequences. Hezbollah, Hamas, they've stretched the Israeli military to its breaking point. It's now forced to fight on multiple fronts. This is part of why Syria had to go. Can you imagine opening up a third front? So now it's an ideological movement against occupation and colonialism, especially the most obnoxious liberal pornocracy of the Western world. If Hezbollah didn't exist, Israeli and American aggression would go unchecked. If Syria hadn't been touched, it would be a different story. Or if Saddam Hussein was still in Iraq, it would be a different story. But even from the ashes come groups like this. When it comes to basic morals, Hezbollah is far superior to anything the U.S. can offer. Yes, Hezbollah helped Syria defeat the Zionist-backed ISIS and all these other groups. And people forget that as all of a sudden ISIS starts attacking ancient Christian communities and towns, like Maulia, a town in Syria, you know, they've been there living amongst Muslims for a millennium and a half, and all of a sudden ISIS comes out of nowhere and starts attacking them. They have no strategic value whatsoever. And this is one of the ways you know that there's a Jewish hand in this. Maulia is an ancient Orthodox city that out of nowhere came under attack from al-Nusra for no gain. Hezbollah was there defending the Christians there. If Hezbollah didn't exist, Lebanon would have long since been invaded. They put their money where their mouth is, and Israel can't beat them for a whole lot of reasons. It's been a while now. It's been, 25 years since that old myth of IDF invincibility has been shattered. Now, given American policy towards Lebanon, towards Gaza, towards the West Bank, and everything else, there's a few people I want to talk about. To be a part of the bureaucracy in State Department or Defense, you have to be a conformist. You actually have to have a bureaucratic mentality. There's a few schools of thought, though. The first one is that Israel doesn't care about world opinion, is defying it, and is hell-bent on destroying any kind of resistance, Arabic or otherwise. It's just a matter of Israel acting maliciously. Now, none of this exists in the federal government or anything like that. There's another one where it's the neocons dominating U.S. foreign policy that exploit the Israelis in the sense that they're carrying out American national and economic objectives using Israel as its proxy. Now, that's absurd, of course, because no American interest is being served by backing the Zionist regime. And finally, there is a third option where the U.S. and Israel are cooperative, essentially as partners and in full agreement regarding especially the reducing the power of the enemies of the Jews, which would make Israel largely the most important partner there. There is evidence to support that third point of view. I mean, I guess there could be a fourth, that this American foreign policy is broken and has no goals. Recently, a writer mentions the $8.7 billion aid package sent to Israel when Americans were dying in North Carolina, and then FEMA couldn't function at all thanks to the millions of illegals and other immigrants from the South that have to be dealt with. FEMA claims to have run out of money. And of course, none of this really is news. This steady flow of money suggests the U.S. doesn't care, despite its symbolic and ritualized rejections of Israeli policy, at least the most extreme versions. It really doesn't matter because the U.S. fully and self-consciously backs Netanyahu's expansion, not just of Israel, but the war against Hamas and Hezbollah. That exists solely because of the power of Jews in Washington. I don't think a whole lot of people think American objections to Netanyahu's policy are real. But it is assumed that the Israeli lobby will keep American politicians in line, and God forbid that something spiral out of control and help Donald Trump. Of course, I don't believe American elections are real, and who knows what's going to happen. In reality, of course, Kamala Harris will get 15% of the vote. Democrats can't. This is the third time the Democrats have created a ridiculous candidate that barely existed during the primaries. Anyway, so it's going to be rigged one way or the other. The U.S. claims to be opposed to the conflict expanding into other areas, but press releases and reality are usually two very different things. People love to go to the nuclear option, that Israel could use its nuclear weapons that it officially denies exist in their attack on Iran, which means that Russia would be drawn in, and Russia is involved in helping to build up the Iranian military apparatus. Turkey is stuck in the middle. Now, there's four people. There's a few people who have mentioned this. There's one writer who I've cited before, Philip Girardi, who published an article recently on the four people who are controlling, at least bureaucratically, American foreign policy, and who, frankly, are responsible, at least in part, personally, for the situation in the Mideast and elsewhere. So, but there are four people that he cites involved in this and who are crafting and carrying out foreign policy. Obviously, there is no functional president, so this is purely a bureaucratic matter. The four are the CIA director, William Burns, obviously Anthony Blinken, but the other two aren't very well known. Those two men are Amos Hochstein, who was a special negotiator over there, former IDF, and the White House coordinator for the Middle East, the hapless Brett McGurk. Hochstein serves on the board, used to serve on the board of Naftogaz, a state Ukrainian energy firm. He's a lobbyist for oil companies and natural gas firms. McGurk makes me smile because one of his titles was that some time ago he chaired the Committee on Countering ISIL, which means his entire world is a lie. There was no countering ISIL. Clown World is right in his job title. And I had forgotten that Burns has no background in intelligence, which is a little odd for being the head of the CIA. He was ambassador to Russia, and the claim is that he tries to see things from the Russian point of view and does no such thing. He was highly praised for that. And one of the things he said, you get ready for this blockbuster, that Russia is very sensitive about Ukraine becoming a part of NATO. I mean, do you need a specialist to elucidate that? This one of his big discoveries. Blinken is very close, of course, to the unelected Joe Biden, but that doesn't matter because Joe Biden isn't even there, mentally or otherwise. He's been central to American policy in the Middle East and in Ukraine. He's a Jew, of course, sees himself as a protector of Israel, and is now associated with Netanyahu's policies. He backed the murder of Nasrallah, although most people would rather see Netanyahu removed, but One of the most interesting things is that he was caught lying, trying to repress the State Department reports showing that Israel has been deliberately using starvation, killing non-combatants by blocking food aid right at the border. In particular, one large convoy of trucks that could have fed the entire area was deliberately held up at the border until the food became rotten and had to be destroyed. Blinken says that that wasn't taking place despite the fact that there's numerous eyewitnesses and right in the State Department report itself. Of course, Blinken paid no price for this war crime. Nothing about his prestige or how he's honored is affected at all. Amos Hochstein, as I mentioned, is the ambassador to the ambassador at large for the Middle East. Allegedly, he's there to avoid the expansion of the war to into Lebanon, which is nonsensical. This is all smoke and mirrors. It's a stage show. It's clown world. The reality is that Hochstein is involved and is a key person in keeping Israel from being criticized. He is a former IDF. He's born in Israel. Former IDF. He's a Jewish militant. And this is the guy who's going to be doing the negotiating. Former IDF. But this is very typical of the regime's irrationality. And the U.S. is trying to pass itself off as neutral. Now, the National Security Council Coordinator for Africa and the Middle East is Brett McGurk. He's, again, these men are all lifelong bureaucrats. I think Hochstein's a little different because he was in the private sector in the oil industry, of course. And, of course, the whole ISIS-ISIL thing is a laughable joke. And what these four men have in common is, of course, they're hardline Zionists. They are completely out of touch with the people they rule, whether it be in the U.S. or elsewhere. They all went to elite universities, but clearly don't have the intellect for any critical thinking. As far as the press is concerned, they can do no wrong. Blinken got a little bit attacked for the aid thing, but no one demanded his resignation. McGurk actually was one of the people who drafted the Iraqi constitution. Talk about a failure. But no one in the media has noticed this. Ideologically speaking, they are the same, especially in terms of foreign policy orientations. Like the rest of them, their predictions rarely come true. Almost everything they say is eventually proven wrong. None of these guys have an independent point of view. They're not serious thinkers in any way. As I've said before, they construct, invent the enemies of the U.S. rather than understanding them. They have no conception of a worldview outside of the one invented by the world's Jews and the regime as a whole. Of course, they're all liberal, globalist, and absolutely acritical in their thinking, and yet they're considered academics. At least McGurk is. They are lifelong bureaucrats. They don't have any means whatsoever available to them to counter regime preferences and constructions. These are also the men who are trying to get the U.S. involved in a shooting war against Iran and pretty much everyone else. And yet again, they retain their prestige. And with the, especially the latter two, McGurk and Hochstein, are almost entirely unknown. The CIA director is a little bit better known, and of course everyone knows Blinken. Now, there is no president now. So these bureaucrats are trying to convince you that they're working hard to achieve some sort of a ceasefire. Not to mention backing an invasion of Lebanon to create their so-called buffer zone, which is what the South Lebanon Army was doing before 2000. Girardi mentions that the Israeli media are talking about real estate agents are offering properties for Jewish buyers in South Lebanon. Just as Jared Kushner has been, recently peddling seafront lots in Gaza. So they're already in the process of building luxury condos here. Girardi also directed me to a Politico article on Hochstein and McGurk that pretty much treated them in a way that you would respect. And The guys who are promoted so heavily by BlackRock, by the regime, are, believe it or not, obsessed with war. Politico had insider information from sources in Washington and Israel that Biden was fully behind Benjamin Netanyahu's strategy to shift the focus to Lebanon. But I don't think you really need inside information for that. And to journals like Politico, maybe this sort of thing, which is day-to-day for us, is out there for your normie, especially your normie who has a vested professional and personal interest in maintaining the regime's point of view and everything. I also, though, have to note that the Pentagon is not on board with a lot of this. I mean, the only way that they could be on board with this is if they have absolutely no connection to the men under their command. There's no women. Women are not involved in combat, nor have they ever been. And it's not merely, you know, the loss of life, but it's simply impossible. There's plenty in the Pentagon. If there's one place that may want to put the brakes on this, this is why the military gets purged all the time in the U.S. But Politico reports that Hochstein and McGurk were working conspiratorially, that is, behind the scenes, to encourage Israel to invade Lebanon. It's a, according to them, a history-defining moment to reshape the Middle East for the better. They are personally responsible, or at least in part, for the deaths of thousands. And they can do this because their world is sanitized and censored. They couldn't explain to you our point of view if they were paid to. They're involved in genocide that Netanyahu's, but Israel's always done, to make a greater Israel largely free from Arabs. There is no chance they're going to defeat Hezbollah, let alone Iran. And this plan, of course, like everything the U.S. tries to do in terms of foreign policy, is going to come to nothing. Again, Hezbollah is better equipped and more motivated than they've ever been. They probably have a tough time handling the possibility of recruits, given what's happened over the last year. And you have people so stupid that they refer to the unelected president, Joe Biden, as an actual normal person that could actually make decisions. He can do no such thing. So it comes down to this. For the Likud party and most American Jews to achieve its regional ambitions, Tel Aviv has to lure the Americans into war with Iran, which is no small task. Israel has to strike Iran with enough force to provoke an intensive retaliation. If Israel is now in trouble, the U.S. will be there. Don't overestimate the rationality of the regime. You have all of northern Western Europe deliberately dismantling their economies to support sanctions on Russia. Don't think that there's anything that's too extreme for them. So Israel has to produce a provocation to fool Americans into going to war. Now, the normie American thinks that the U.S. would prevail. They think that Iran is a third world country and it's anything but. Iran has been preparing for a war with the U.S. for over two decades. They have allies everywhere. Their missile technology, thanks to the Russians, is far greater than anything available to the Pentagon. And they're quite willing to conduct a protracted war, a so-called asymmetrical war. And it would disrupt the supply lines of the U.S. Washington is going to be defeated, and the Pentagon brass know that this is true. This is part of the reason why the Israelis have been somewhat mute when it comes to retaliation. The military, generally speaking, doesn't want war. It's not just a matter of selecting targets. It's whether or not the U.S. is prepared for this. And of course, they're absolutely not. I mentioned either last week or the week before that the Iranian attack destroyed two, or badly damaged two air bases, the IDM. But the Netanyahu administration did not respond right away. As of right now, there's still really no substantial response, except in Lebanon, because whether it be the State Department and the Pentagon, State Department is fanatical Zionists, the people I've just mentioned, and the actual Pentagon with soldiers in it who don't want to condemn their men to death. Is it possible that Netanyahu will do it anyway without American support, relying on the power of the Jews in the U.S.? The U.S. can't win a conventional war with Iran. Scott Ritter, one of my favorite authors on military topics, when Donald Trump was president, the Iranians shot down a Global Hawk drone, about $100 million apiece. He then got very angry and said, we have to beef up air defense and destroy everything that took down the Global Hawk. The Pentagon told him that if you're going to do this, you will set in motion a cycle of escalation that will end with the Iranians destroying every single one of our bases, and there's nothing that anyone can do to stop them. Iran will shut down the Strait of Hormuz and disrupt global oil supplies. That's what would happen with any kind of serious military action against Iran. It would take months or years to assemble the force needed to take action against a first world militarized society. If Iran has to actually switch over to nuclear power somehow, it takes a long time to do this, to nuclear weapons, they'll do it. The days of the American intimidation factor against Iran is long over. Israel could be wiped out tomorrow. Iran is prepared to fire 2,000 missiles at Israel in the span of a few hours. They would destroy the entire infrastructure of Israel, including power plants, water purification, and Israel has nothing to fall back upon. Ritter also says that the bases in the Middle East, you know, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, UAE, Saudi Arabia, etc. So having these forward military bases are all within range of the formidable arsenal ballistic missiles. And of course, cruise missiles and drones. Iran, her allies have shown that they will use all three types of this against the U.S. Iran has the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the region. Their short-range ballistic missiles are capable of destroying all of these bases in all of these countries. And their SRBMs use solid propellants, meaning that they require less time to set up prior to launch, and they can be stored for longer periods of time. In other words, American bases are overexposed and would be obliterated by the Iranians. It'll take 5 minutes or less for missiles launched from Iran to reach these places. Yeah, they're defended by Patriot and batteries, but at such close range, it's not going to do much good. Plus, there's not enough missiles for this. The Empire cannot maintain its bases in a full-blown conflict because Iran is capable of sustained attack. This is imperial overreach. And, of course, the Iranians have put all of this together. Now, as I talked about at some length, there were two attacks from Iran on Israel, the first in April of 2024, and, of course, the more famous one on October 1st. I talked about the Nevatim and Haretzim air bases, either destroyed or damaged, and the Iron Dome had nothing to do with any of this. Now, the Pentagon claimed that 81 of these projectiles were shot down by American air defenses. Later on, for the October 1st attack, I'm sorry, the first one was the April attack. The October 1st attack, the Pentagon said that a dozen of the 180 missiles were shot down by the destroyers, the USS Spokele and the USS Cole. And these are fairly sophisticated ships that are designed for this kind of thing. And so clearly, if in the April attack, and I think this is an exaggeration, is 81 shot down. I don't believe that's true because, you know, on October 1st, there was just a handful of the 180 were shot down. That was not, if you remember, the media's initial claim. I have a problem believing that anything like that is going to change. Now, there's a few writers who talk about the Navy. If you go to my Patreon page, you'll see where I went into great detail to show how weak the American Navy has become, especially spread all over the place. There was no, and continues to be, no American aircraft carrier strike group in the Mediterranean when the October 1st attacks took place. The USS Truman went into the Mediterranean only 2 days later. So over the last year, there has been a relatively small number of ships sent to defend Israel. But even with the widening of the war to Lebanon, there's been no increase, no change, actually, in the number of American warships available. But in 1973, the U.S. had 60 ships in the Arab-Israeli war there. Now, the ships that allegedly shot these missiles down, they only had two there in the Mediterranean. This isn't a strategic choice. This is the result of weakness. The full U.S. Navy's combat force has 279 ships, of which 237 are actual combat ships. Sailable, maybe 71. So 106 ships out of a total of 295 are deployed, and that shows you how bad the combat readiness of the Navy is. It's going to take years and years and billions of dollars to bring this up to what the Americans think is proper levels. I don't know if you've read the report, NAVPLAN 24, from Admiral Lisa Franchetti, which makes me smile. And, of course, she's trying to sweep it under the rug. Remember, there's an alleged war that's going to start in China in 2027. China has the largest shipbuilding infrastructure in the entire world. State-owned, of course. There is the attempt in this report to bring the Navy up to 80% combat readiness. Right now, it's 35%, and that's being very generous. That's how bad off the American Navy is. It's very optimistic to allow this to go up to 50%. To bring it up to 80% is an impossibility. And the real issue is maintenance and repair. If things work normally, which they do not, any ship after its tour of duty would take but 12 to 15 months. But that system doesn't work anymore. Right now, the backlog in terms of maintenance on all the warships, cruisers, destroyers, whatever, is 2,700 days behind. That's what? 6.5 years. What this Lisa wants to do is to create a fleet of unmanned vessels. But, of course, that only begs the question because the U.S. is a blue water navy. Any kind of warfare, there's going to be large tonnage platforms to navigate as a requirement, and they're nowhere to be found. The foundation of naval power requires bases and the support of these in wartime. That's the only way that warships around the globe can receive the ammunition and fuel support. But it doesn't exist. The merchant fleet is insufficient. That what the U.S. is able to offer now, with 35% combat effectiveness, with very few resources to change that, to fight either Russia or China in this regard, let alone both of them, is an impossibility. A few writers pointed out that the combat vehicles of just one mechanized division weigh about 100,000 tons. We don't seem to realize often how difficult it is that the U.S. doesn't have the capacity to move materiel around that well. NATO itself says that the tonnage and the possibility of a war with a major power, the reinforcement for the supplementary supplies in the first months of war in Europe was about 25 million tons with 100 million barrels of oil. The U.S. doesn't have the capacity to deal with any of this. The distances are even greater in the Pacific. And all of these convoys need to be protected. There are not enough ships for any of this. Now, the Congress back in 2023 approved a target of 381 ships, 397 by 2053. But to come close to the target, a huge 20% budget increase is required. It's just not possible today. Right now, 40% of submarines in the U.S. Navy is under repair, and the delays are getting worse and worse and worse. Not to mention the more obvious point that the carrier strike groups are very vulnerable to the hypersonic and ballistic missiles, many of which were designed for that purpose. If war were to break out tomorrow, the American Navy would have very little chance of winning. Now, I should note that the figures that I've been citing to you come from a retired admiral named Sem Gordines. So this isn't a nobody who doesn't know what they're talking about. This is someone who knows the Navy very well. The resources just aren't there. The American Navy has collapsed compared to what it was at the start of the first Iraq War in 1990. The delays for maintenance make it almost impossible that even the ships that exist be combat ready for any length of time. The American Navy is in no position to win anything. Logistics alone, there's not enough ships in the merchant marine to deal with these logistical difficulties. The massive amount of tons that you need to supply a force in combat is prohibitive. And that includes the short and medium terms. Not to mention replenishing weapons and ammunition stocks, which is nowhere to be found, too. The Undersecretary of the Navy, Seth Kropsky, says that if the Americans don't increase the production of weapons that it will need in the Pacific theater, especially hypersonics, it will lose a war in the Taiwan situation in a matter of weeks. And it's not going to be remedied anytime soon. They could barely maintain the bases that exist because of logistics and protecting those convoys or, flotillas, whatever you want to call them, is very, very expensive, and the U.S. doesn't have the equipment. China is more advanced than the Americans in terms of naval assets. Of course, they also don't have the burden of a multi-trillion dollar commitment to this massive web of overseas bases. The response a year ago to the war in Israel was very anemic compared to what could have been the case between 71 and 73. A huge decrease in the number of ships available. And the quality of these ships is getting worse and worse. You go to Patreon and see my article on the Navy. Training is down to nothing for officers. They're given a bunch of DVDs and asked to watch them. And the point of it all is that the U.S., given a lot of the logistical things that we don't consider when we consider a war far away, are very expensive, very difficult to protect. The available ships, the weaponry, everything like that, the available ships are simply not there. Franchetti tries to cover that up, but there's no way she can do that. The backlog of maintenance alone. To think that the Iranians or the Chinese or even Hezbollah doesn't know this? I don't even know if the Truman, how many, in naval aviation, something like 20% of the planes or jets are capable of flying. Again, for this very same reason. That's what Hezbollah, that's what the Iranians, the axis of resistance in general, that's what they're looking at. It's very possible that the end of the liberal regime might be coming, especially in terms of foreign policy. But that Jewish lobby demands that we be involved in the Middle East and in surrounding areas, reducing the countries around them to third world status, plunging millions into poverty. That's the nature of American foreign policy. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.